Okay, I think we'll start. If everyone, there'll be a sample Skardiska if anyone didn't get one. I think we'll leave them in the back on the chair. Okay, so by way of introduction, my name is Ben Blumenfeld. I'm president of the Sims Student Council. We have been off to a great start this year. I've had a lot of exciting events and a lot of great energy. And as always, we're interested in your input and your feedback. And if you ever have any suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Thank you all for coming tonight to the first in a unique series of lectures sponsored by the Sims Student Council. This lecture, titled The Role of Ribbis and the Skardiska in the Modern Marketplace, is the first in a series of business halacha lectures focusing on the inherent conflicts in a variety of business disciplines. We hope to have additional lectures as part of this series, so please stay tuned for more information. For tonight's lecture, there are few people more qualified to discuss the practical aspects of interest and lending and their halachic implications in the modern marketplace than our very own Rabbi Yonah Ries Shlita. Rabbi Ries is the Dean of Ries. He is a Yad and Yad Musmach of Ries and an attorney who was an associate for 6 years at the international law firm Cleary Gottlieb Steen in Hamilton. He is a graduate of Yale Law School, where he served as senior editor of the Yale Law Journal. He currently serves on the editorial board of Tradition Magazine and has published articles in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Law Journal. Prior to becoming the Dean of Ries, Rabbi Ries also served as the director of the Beth Din of America. Please welcome Rabbi Ries.
Thank you. I think there's some people outside. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be able to be here this evening to address you on the important topic of ribbis, prohibited interest according to Jewish law and its ramifications in a business setting. I gather that most of you who are attending are part of the Sims School of Business, formerly known as the SISIM School of Business, and that you all have some interest from a very practical perspective in understanding how ribbis prohibitions are going to affect your own financial careers, how it's going to affect your business enterprises. So I wanted to touch upon a little bit of this topic this evening, and also to take any questions that you might have in the time that we have together. So the first thing that I should establish, just by way of introduction, is that there is such a prohibition. According to Jewish law, according to halacha, there is a prohibition known as ribbis, that you're not allowed to loan money to a fellow Jew for purposes of collecting a repayment of that money with an additional interest charge. So it's prohibited, according to Torah law, for me to stipulate that I'm going to loan you $100 on condition that you're going to repay me $101. $100 would be a repayment of the principal, and then the extra $1 would be a payment of interest. It doesn't matter how small the amount is, it's prohibited according to Torah law. I'm not allowed to charge you interest. There's a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, says, in Kesed Tabes Amias Ani Machlos Yelo Kenoshelo Sisimun Olav Neshech. If there is a halva transaction, there is a loan transaction, somebody needs money. That's what we call the ani. The ani is the poor person. The poor person needs the money. I'm extending the money. Lo Sisimun Olav Neshech. I'm not allowed to place a burden of Neshech, a burden of a ribbis payment upon this individual. So on the basis of the lashon of the pasuk, im kesef talve esami, the Gemara derives that the only type of interest which is prohibited according to Torah law, the only prohibited ribbis is ribbis above milova lamalbit, is ribbis in a loan transaction. It has to be in the context of a loan transaction. We might be able to conjure up other situations where somebody owes me money, and where we say for every single month or for every single year that you don't pay me, you're going to have to pay an extra premium. Like, for example, if I sell you something, but I sell you something, but you didn't pay me right away. Instead, you pay me a few months later. So we say, well, if you don't pay me right away, then for every single month, you're going to have to pay me an extra $10. You're going to have to pay me an extra 2% of the entire transaction. So that's also prohibited, but that's prohibited only midrabanan. That's considered to be rabbinically prohibited interest. Because the Torah only prohibits interest that's in the context of a loan transaction. And then there are other types of gifts or additional payments that the Gemara also describes as prohibited, not because it's Torah prohibited interest or rabbinically prohibited interest, but what we call Mexican ribbis. It looks like ribbis. It kind of has the specter of being in the ballpark of a ribbis. For example, you give me a little bit of a gift, and it's understood that afterwards I'm going to extend a loan to you. So that wasn't in the context of the transaction, or I made a loan to you, and you paid me back the exact same amount that I loaned to you, and then 5 months later you give me an extra little gift. So it's clear that the extra little gift that you're giving me 5 months later is because I was nice enough to extend a loan to you, which was paid back only the exact amount that I loaned to you. Nonetheless, either of those cases, either the early gift, the Matana Mukdemis, or the late gift, the Matana Milcheres, so those are prohibited as well because they're kind of in the realm of being a penumbra of ribbis. They're kind of similar to, they look like, they smell like real ribbis. So therefore, that's also considered to be prohibited. And there are different laws as to what are the ramifications as to whether it's biblically prohibited interest, or whether it's rabbinically prohibited interest, or whether it's only an extra chumrah, an extra stringency that we treat it like ribbis, has to do with, for example, whether the ribbis has to be returned. If I collected interest from somebody wrongly, if it's biblically prohibited interest, so then it's yotze b'dayanim. It's called ribbis ketzutza yotze b'dayanim. If I collected biblically prohibited interest, so then I have to give it back to you. If I collected rabbinically prohibited interest, so then I don't have to give it back to you. So there is an interesting halacha, which is that if there is a shtar, if there is a contract that we enter into, in which I charge you interest, but I specify that I'm loaning you $100, so it's specified what amount is the principal, and I specify you're going to pay me back $100 of principal, plus you're going to pay me back $15 of interest. So it's very clearly laid out which is the principal and which is the interest. So then I want to enforce later on my shtar. I want to enforce my contract afterwards because you didn't pay me back, so I take you to Beis Din. So the halakha is, what does Beis Din require you to pay? So Beis Din will say, you're not required to pay the interest to me because the interest is prohibited according to Jewish law. But you are required to pay the principal to me. So we do bifurcate the transaction. We say, even though an issur and a prohibition was committed, nonetheless, permitted part is something that you're supposed to repay. It's only the prohibited part that you're not supposed to repay. So I get $100 that I loaned, I get back. The extra $15 I'm not allowed to collect. So I was once speaking to an attorney just this past year, and I was talking about some of the dimensions of the Jewish law prohibition upon interest, upon ribbis, and he explained to me that in his field, he deals a lot with the loan transactions that are interest-bearing, and from the perspective of secular law, you wouldn't think that there's any kind of prohibition of interest, right? Because this is just something in the Torah. It's something between Jews that one Jew loans to another Jew. He's not allowed to collect interest. So the reality is that there are laws concerning prohibited interest, even in secular law. And those are laws that are described as usury laws. Usury is basically is prohibited interest according to secular law. It's not every single transaction that's usury. Usury is only if it exceeds a certain threshold. So under secular law, let's say in the state of New York, if two people enter into a transaction and they're not Jewish, so they're allowed to charge each other interest up to 15%. But if it's 16%, so then already it's not considered to be permissible anymore. That's what's called civilly prohibited interest. That would be in violation of the New York usury laws. And if it's 25% interest, then it would actually be a criminal violation in New York State. There are some exceptions depending on the amount of the transaction, depending upon the nature of who the borrower is, whether it's an individual person or whether it's a corporation. But generally speaking, in New York State, one is not allowed to charge interest above the threshold of 16%. That would be civilly prohibited interest. So this lawyer turned to me and he said that if he has clients who have entered into an interest-bearing transaction that is prohibited both according to Jewish law and according to secular law, so then he would always advise them that if he's representing the lender, that the lender would do much better in Bezdin than the lender would do in civil court. Normally, if it's an interest-bearing transaction, so the lender is going to do worse in Bezdin. We assume everyone wants to follow halacha, but let's just imagine for a second, a person just wants to go, they'll get the best deal. So the lender generally will do worse in Bezdin because the Bezdin will say, even if you charge one penny of interest, you're not allowed to collect that one penny, while in court they'll allow you to collect up until 16%. But if the person actually charged 16% of interest and they went into a secular court, so the rule under secular law is that any interest-bearing loan above the threshold of 16% is null and void and is completely unenforceable. So therefore, the lender wouldn't be able to collect anything. The lender wouldn't be able to collect the interest, and the lender wouldn't be able to collect the principal. While if the lender in that case, where they charged a loan of 16% or more, went to Bezdin, so Bezdin would say you can't collect the interest, but you would at least be allowed to collect the principal. So this attorney said that he would certainly advise a client who was a lender to, in such a situation, go to Bezdin, where they would be able to collect much more than they would be able to collect in secular court. So I pointed out, of course, that would only be true if we were talking about a case where the loan exceeded the threshold of prohibited interest. But if it was less than 16%, obviously it'll be able to collect more in secular court, then the person would be able to collect more in Bezdin. Also, I said, it's not entirely clear that if the amount that was exceeded was 16% of the interest rate, that the person would even be allowed to collect in Bezdin. So he said, why not? So I said, because usury laws are considered to be matters of public policy concern. There are all kinds of laws. There are laws and there are laws. There are laws that are enacted that simply establish a default threshold of what should be the understanding under secular law between parties who enter into a transaction. But if parties want to enter into a different understanding, they want to enter into a side contract that's different from the regular secular law, so we would permit them to do so, much like in halacha. We have a rule that if somebody borrows an object and there is a show, they're a showel, and then there's some damage to the object, so even if the damage was no fault of the showel here, it was a complete onus, the showel is still responsible. So the Mishnah, the Gemara, and Baba Metzia say that if a showel wanted to work out a special arrangement with the mashiel, with the person who was loaning him the object, and say, well, between you and me, even though normally speaking the deal is that I'll be liable for any type of accident, but we'll make a special arrangement between the two of us that I'm not going to be liable for any accident that occurs. I'll only be liable for negligence. So in such a case, that's considered to be enforceable, that people are allowed to make their own side bargains when it comes to monetary laws. So that's true in secular law too. There are many laws where people would be allowed to make their own side bargains. However, when it comes to matters of public policy, matters that the government has such a strong interest in the regulation of the law, then in matters of public policy, the government does not allow parties to independently contract to go against whatever the secular law says. So usury is considered to be in the realm of public policy. So if two people say between themselves, according to halakha, this is always true, but even according to secular law, two people say, well, between you and me, it's okay, we'll have a loan which is more than 16%. So that's not countenance. So by the same token, when you go to Bezdin, so Bezdin has the ability under secular law to enforce judgments according to halakha, according to Jewish law. However, the enforcement then needs to be actually enforced by the secular court. Let's say Bezdin issues a judgment, and then one party doesn't want to pay. So then the winning party has to take the Bezdin decision, the written decision of the Bezdin, and has to go to civil court and say, look, we signed an arbitration agreement that we're going to settle our disputes in Bezdin. The Bezdin ruled in my favor, and I want you to enforce the award that the Bezdin awarded to me. So then a secular court will enforce the award. But when it comes to matters of public policy, when it comes to matters where the secular court and the secular government has a very strong, overwhelming interest that the law not be violated or not be changed in any way from the way that the secular statute reads, so then a Bezdin decision would not necessarily be enforceable. So therefore, if there was a contract that called for a 20% interest, and the parties went to Bezdin, and Bezdin said, it's okay, we're not going to enforce the interest because the interest is contrary to halakha, but we'll let you collect the principal, and then you could then the winning party is not paid by the losing party, even the principal, so the winning party has to take the Bezdin decision, which allows him to collect the principal and take that decision to secular court to get it enforced. So I said, it's not obvious. It's not obvious to me that the secular court would actually even enforce the collection of the principal, because they might say that the Bezdin decision is contrary to public policy. However, there is a way out of all of these problems according to Jewish law, according to halacha. What's the way out of all of these problems? So the way out of these problems is a device which is based on the Gemara and Baba Masiyah Daf Kuf Vav, which is based on discussions in the Rishonim, Tumas Hadeshin and others, that there is a device which can convert what would appear to be a loan transaction into what's essentially an iska. An iska is a loosely defined. It's like a joint venture transaction where two people are entering into a business venture rather than entering into a loan. If you're making me a payment as part of a business venture that we enter into together, as opposed to making me a ribis, an interest payment, so that would be considered to be acceptable even according to halacha. So I would be able to give you money and say that I'm expecting not only the money back, but a little bit of a premium, a little bit extra on the money, and there's a way of doing it as long as it's done through an iska arrangement where we say that there's no violation of ribis and where this would be perfectly enforceable according to halacha, according to Jewish law. So the question is, how does the iska arrangement work? How do you avoid interest payments according to halacha? How do you somehow transform this transaction that would seemingly be a ribis-bearing transaction into a joint venture transaction where I would be able to collect my dividends? So the answer is, well, the very nature of a venture transaction, of an ISCA transaction, is that I'm not guaranteed my return. So when you give me my return, it's because there was a little bit of a risk involved, and maybe I was going to get it, maybe I wasn't going to get it. It's like any kind of investment. When you invest money, there's a possibility, right, that you're going to lose the money. So therefore, the whole like premise of the ISCA transaction is that there is a chance that I will lose the money. However, what we do is we diminish that probability as much as possible so that we make it more likely that I will be able to collect the money, but through a device in which it is also possible for me not to collect the money. How does this work exactly? So what we can say is, I'm going to loan you money for a business proposition, and you are going to, I'm the lender, let's say, you're the borrower, and I'm going to lend you the money that you're going to invest for business purposes. However, we don't know whether this business venture is going to yield profits or not yield profits. We're going to split the profits 50-50, okay? We're going to say, if there are profits, so I'm going to get 50% and you'll keep 50%. If there are losses, so I'll lose up to 50% of my investment, and you'll bear the other 50%. The way that we construe the money that has been given over from me to you is that I'm sort of guaranteed 50% of the money that I'm giving you, but that's not exactly a great business proposition, because if I give you $1 million, it's not of great comfort to me that I know that I'm guaranteed that I'm going to get back $500,000. I want to be guaranteed I'm going to get back $1 million plus. But the way that it technically works is that $500,000 are considered to be a loan from me to you, in which you have an obligation to repay me the loan, but I also can't collect any interest or make any demands on how you're going to, on any additional payment that you would make to me. And the other $500,000 is a pikadon. The other $500,000 is something that I'm giving you purely for investment purposes. I want you to invest the money, and if you lose the money, so I can lose that entire portion of what I'm giving you. I can lose that entire $500,000. That's a chatzi milver, giving you half of a loan. Chatzi pikadon, I'm giving you half of a deposit, and the deposit, I understand, I can lose entirely. But if there's a profit, so then I get 50% of the profit, and we figure out a profit, since only half of it is the investment, that's going to be double of what I really want to collect from you. And if there's a loss, so I'll share in one half of the loss. So I'm still very much exposed, because I can lose a half of what I've given to you. So I haven't made things so much better. So here's where some of the cleverness of the device of the what's called the shtar iska. Shtar iska is an iska contract. We often refer to it as a heter iska. Why do we call it a heter iska? It's not a heter iska, it's a shtar iska. It's a iska contract. We call it a heter iska because through this shtar iska, through this iska contract, we're going to create a heter. We're going to make it permissible for me to give you money in such a way that I'm going to get the return that I want. What do we say? We say, okay, so it's true that if there are losses, I'm going to have to share in the losses. That's true, 100%. But how should I believe you that there are losses? You're going to go off, you're going to invest. I give you carte blanche permission to invest in a million different things. Whatever you want to invest in, I don't know what you're investing in. So how in the world am I going to know that there are losses? You'll come to me and you'll say, I'm sorry, I can't repay the full amounts of the chatzi pikud or anything because I lost all of the money. I say, I don't believe you. So we establish in our contract that the only way that I will believe you is if you bring two trustworthy witnesses. It's very hard to find two trustworthy witnesses. This is before they created the Sim School of Business. So it's very hard to find two individuals who meet all the criteria to be trustworthy Aiden, and who will be able to testify, who are able to watch every single aspect of your investment, that they're going to be able to testify for sure that you suffered a loss. Not only that, but the Truma Sedeshin said that we can even identify who those witnesses are going to be. We can stipulate that these witnesses are going to be the Rosh Yeshiva and the Mashkiach, two people who have no idea what's going on in the business world, who are just sitting in the base medrash all day, and there's no way in the world they'll ever be able to testify. But nonetheless, because maybe theoretically they'll be able to, they'll pick up the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and they'll actually see what's going on with the various investments, and maybe they really could testify if they tried really hard. So therefore, it's not considered to be too much of a ruse if, even if you mention the specific witnesses, these are the stipulations that were agreed upon, that I'll only believe you, and I only have to believe you that you suffered a loss in the event that you produce these witnesses. So that's one part of the contract, that we say that it's true, you don't have to pay me if there are losses, the part of the investment that is a deposit, but nonetheless, I don't have to believe you that there were losses unless you can produce two trustworthy witnesses. And we can go further and say, what about the fact that there's no profit? You can't bring witnesses to testify that there was no profit, because there's nothing to see. Witnesses can see that you lost your money. They can see that you took your money and you went to the racetrack, or you went to the gambling casino and you wasted all your money on gambling. So they can see, they're standing there. So they're standing at the casino, they're already possible to be witnesses. That's why it's hard to find witnesses. So your witnesses will be able to testify with respect to the loss. But how in the world are you going to find witnesses to testify there was no profit? They can't testify. You can't see something like that there was no profit. It's not something that witnesses could easily testify about. It's not a tangible thing that you took money and they see that there's no profit. So with respect to the testimony, if there was no profit, for that we have to rely on some other device. We rely on the device that you would have to take an oath in order to swear as to how much profit there was. That I might, you might want to say, well, you wanted to collect 6% profit, but really there was only 3% profit. So then I can say to you, well, I'm sorry, but you have to take an oath. And under Jewish law, the taking of an oath is a very, very weighty matter. The whole earth shook when it was decreed that the person who takes a false oath will not be able to be cleansed from his sin. This is considered to be one of the most terrible avers. Violation of the Aseret Sedivos, a person who takes a false oath. So we know that in the Jewish tradition, there's a tremendous hesitation from ever taking any oaths. Even when a person goes to court and they're supposed to tell the truth, it's not like they're going to be lying. But a Jewish witness will always insist that instead of having to say that he swears, do you swear that you're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So the person, a Jewish person, will usually say, I don't want to swear. Because Jews don't swear, right? I tell my kids all the time, Jews don't swear. I want to affirm. See, they'll affirm, they won't swear. So taking an oath is a very, very big deal, and nobody is going to want to agree to take an oath. So this is another surefire way to assume, to assure that the borrower, as it were, quote-unquote borrower, a person who's receiving the funds, will not be able to testify or prove that there were less profits than that which was expected. So therefore, I strike a deal with the borrower, and I say, you know what, you don't want to take a note about the profits, and you don't want to provide witnesses to prove that there were any losses. And maybe, in fact, there won't be any losses, and maybe there'll be wonderful profits, and maybe there'll be even more profits than what I am anticipating and what I am hoping to collect, and really I could have collected much more money, because the profits will be so tremendous. So instead of you having to take any oaths proving that there was less profits, or even having to shell out if there were more profits, so instead of having you to have to produce witnesses that there were no losses, we'll just make it easy. We will establish between the two of us that if you pay a set sum, you pay a set amount, we'll establish what that amount is based on the anticipated amount of profits. We anticipate 10% profits, therefore my share should be 5%. then I will absolve you from having to produce any witnesses. I will absolve you from having to take any oaths. I will not insist on investigating to see if the profits were even greater so that I should get a bigger share. I will simply be content with your paying me this set amount, and then you won't be burdened with all these other obligations. So this is basically the way that the Shtar Iska works. The Shtar Iska works through this mechanism that really you should have had to take an oath, and really you should have had to produce witnesses, but in lieu, instead of having your take the oath, instead of having to produce the witnesses, I'm going to let you off the hook if you pay a set amount of money. So therefore, it's not a guaranteed amount. Really, technically speaking, you could bring the witnesses. Technically speaking, you could take the oath. But because I am letting you off the hook, if you pay a set amount, so it's on that basis that you're paying that amount. So if this would be a strictly standard loan transaction where I'm the lender and you're the borrower and there's no venture agreement and there's no splitting of profits or losses, this would just be interest. I'm paying you $100, you're paying me back, say, $120. But instead, what we say is I'm going to give you $100 and you're going to give me 50% of the profits, so I'll share 50% of the losses for my investment. However, this is only if I'll only suffer the loss if you can prove it through witnesses or taking an oath. But you know what? If you give me an extra $20, so then I'll let you off the hook from having to produce witnesses or taking an oath. So therefore, it's the same result. I still get the same $120, but because I entered into the Shtar Iska document, because we did it in the context of an Iska agreement, therefore, this is not prohibited according to halacha. This is considered to be 100% permissible, and we have thereby averted any ribis problems. So therefore, this is what is encouraged with respect to any transactions, any loan transactions that would otherwise be interest-bearing transactions between two Jewish parties. And this is the standard device which is utilized across the board, Bisman Hazeh, in order to avoid ribis problems. There's a much bigger problem if people don't enter into the Shtar Iska, because then you really can't collect the ribis, you really can't collect the interest. And if it's biblically prohibited interest, you're even going to have to return it. Yes?
How does using the Shtar Iska compare with other Shtar, like a Shtar Mechira or a Shemitah, or in different situations, meaning it's frowned upon in some situations to use it as a point of averting, you know, what the din is, and in some situations it's a matter of preference to use it, or in terms of the other stars that we have, how does it line up in terms of how it's viewed?
Now, the Torah Tamim has an interesting comment when he talks about the laws of ribis and the widespread use of Shtar Iska, and he says, well, we know that there are certain shtaros that are not considered to be preferable according to Jewish law, that are just sort of devices that are used as loopholes to get around the real letter of the law. And should we have a similar perspective towards the Shtar Iska? And he gives this whole big argument as to why he thinks that it's not applicable to the Shtar Iska, because he said the whole premise of the laws of ribis were based on mechei achicha imach, that you don't want to take advantage of people, and it used to be that money wasn't even the main source of investment or commerce. It was karka, it was the work that people did in real estate, so the money was sort of ancillary to the main transactions people were involved with. And if you took advantage of somebody's vulnerable situation to make them pay back extra money, that really was infringing upon their personal viability in a way which is in contradiction to the Torah's imperative of Bechei Achicha Imach. But he said that nowadays that so many people do business not through real estate. He said now we're kind of like nomads. We sort of wander from place to place. And the main livelihood of many people is in commerce and in money and in trading in money and in involving engaging in transactions that are loan transactions or that are at least the interest, at least let's say business type of transaction where you're taking money and you're investing money and you're looking for the return that you're going to get on your money. So therefore, he said in this particular context, it was not it's not the spirit of the Torah to prohibit these types of ventures where you're basically dealing in money for your livelihood, provided that you do it in a manner in which you're making it very clear that this is in fact a business investment. And all that the Shtar Iska is doing is memorializing the reality of the situation, that when you're engaged in these transactions, you're primarily engaged in these transactions for purposes of business transactions. Now, again, this rationale primarily makes sense when it's really a business transaction, meaning when you're really investing money like you will be doing in the business marketplace in real investments, and you're loaning, even if from a secular perspective, it's a loan transaction, it really is a transaction in which you're giving money to one party in order to enable them to make money, and for you to benefit from the overall transaction, you're going to get back a better return on your investment. So even if it's structured from a secular perspective as a loan, it really is two people or organizations partnering in what's essentially an investment opportunity. It becomes more complicated when the transaction in question is not a business transaction per se, but when you are actually extending a personal loan to somebody. If you're actually extending a personal loan and you want to collect ribbis, you want to collect interest from that personal loan and not make it ribbis and not make it into prohibited interest, so then that becomes more questionable because, number one, it's not really a business transaction. And number two, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to work with the assumption that profits are going to be generated from a personal type of transaction. So what certain later poskim pointed out, including the Shaul HaMeshiv, is that even if you're extending money for personal purposes by virtue of that person having the loan for personal purposes, that frees up other money that the person has that they're now able to invest in business transactions. And everybody, or it's assumed that by and large, most people have an interest in being able to invest for business purposes, just like everybody invests, or lots of people invest in the stock market, they have pension funds, they have funds in which they're regularly engaged in investments. So even if they draw money for purposes of buying food or for purposes of household expenses, the reality is that one of the reasons why they need that money is to be able to free up their other money to either make investments or to maintain investments which they have already made. So therefore, even when you're extending money for purposes of a personal loan, you really can structure it or describe it in such a way that you're sharing in that person's general business enterprises. And therefore, it really is a joint venture along these lines. So getting back to our analogy to the secular law regime with respect to usury, so I mentioned that it actually could be problematic for a Beis Din to enforce an interest-bearing agreement, if they're only enforcing the principal, the payment of the principal, rather than the interest, because according to secular law, you're not really even allowed to collect the principal if it's above 16%, according to American civil law. So there's a very interesting secular case. The case is called Leibovitz versus Verwicki, and it's a 1968 case. And even though the parties don't sound Jewish, this was a Jewish case, and the question arose that there was an interest-bearing transaction between two parties that actually was more than the permitted amount of interest under secular law. So therefore, the borrower, as it were, wanted to void the entire transaction and not pay the loan back altogether. But it was done subject to a shtar iska. It was done subject to one of these iska devices that we just mentioned. So since it was done subject to a shtar iska, the extender of the funds, known as the lender under secular law, the person who extended the funds said that this is not really a regular loan agreement, this is more of a joint venture agreement. And since it's a joint venture agreement where there's the possibility of profit but also the possibility of loss on the part of the investor, therefore I should be allowed to collect the full amount of the loan because it's not in violation, it's not really a loan, and the amount of interest is not really interest, but it's just a return on my investment. And the court actually ruled that because this was brought to a court, not to a Beis Din, but the court actually ruled that because of the fact that there was a shtar iska, the shtar iska not only made the collection of interest permissible for Jewish law purposes, that we don't need the court to tell us, we know that already, But the Shtar Iska actually made the collection of interest permissible for secular law purposes as well. Because part of the usury statute under New York law is that it has to be clearly the intention of the parties for the transaction to be usurious. And because they entered into a Shtar Iska, which indicated that their real intention was that this be some sort of a joint venture agreement, and therefore that clearly demonstrated that their intention was not to collect prohibited interest, but rather to collect a return on an investment, and therefore the usury statute under New York law was not applicable to this transaction, and therefore it was kosher v'yosher for them to collect, for the lender to collect, both under halacha and under secular law as well. So therefore, the best piece of advice that this lawyer could give his client would be make sure that you always have a shtar iska, because the shtar iska is going to protect you under both halacha and under secular law, according to this decision. Of course, that creates a potential separate problem, and the potential separate problem that it might create is that once a court is already accepting the description of a transaction as a joint venture, then they might actually interpret it as a joint venture in a manner which goes far beyond anything contemplated by the parties according to halacha. Namely, that according to halacha, all that it means is that I might lose the investment, or I might lose the payments, or actually under the original form shtar iska, 50% of the payment that I originally made to you. But under secular law, sharing in the losses in a joint venture doesn't only mean sharing in the losses to the degree of my investment or 50% of my investment, but means that if you invest in a venture of $1 million and the whole venture goes sour, and now you have liabilities to creditors for $1 million, and I made you a $50,000 loan and said we're going to make this into a shtar iska, suddenly I'm not only out my $50,000 or $25,000, but I'm out $500,000 because I agreed to share equally in all losses of this joint venture. So that's not what is intended under the halachic form of the shtar iska. But if you use the terminology of joint venture, then a secular court might potentially interpret the document as giving rise to that type of liability. So therefore, it's important to provide a little bit of extra protection as well and make clear that even though for halakhic purposes it's an iska if translated into English would read something like joint venture, but nonetheless iska is a different term and it's a different regime and it's subject to different legal rules and principles. So it's important to make very clear in all of your documentation that this is not intended to be a joint venture under secular law, but this is only intended as a halakhic document under Jewish law in order to provide for the appropriate mechanism under Jewish law for this to be structured as a partnership, a transaction of some sort, but not at all implying what would be implied under secular law with the usage of the same terms. So one has to be careful to kind of balance both interests, to do it in such a way in which it's clear that you don't have the intent to be usurious if the, interest rate is exceedingly high. Again, that's a rare case. Most cases, you're going to probably in the business world be dealing with interest rates which are within the permissible range of interest under secular law. But perhaps even more importantly, to make it very clear, and courts have responded well to this, when you make it very clear that this is really being entered into for Jewish law purposes only, and that the terminology is only the terminology from a Jewish law perspective that calls this an iska, but it's not intended to serve as a joint venture for secular purposes. And if you look at the language of the shtar iska that I handed out from the Beis Din of America, you will see that one advantage of this form is that it clearly casts the execution of this form within the realm of Jewish religious law. In fact, the first three words of the preamble of the introduction is Jewish religious law. So that's helpful, because the court looks at this document and says, Jewish religious law, I understand this is like selling chometz, you know. So they already kind of put it in the appropriate context where they're not going to hold you in all likelihood to a secular law definitions based on the existence of this document. And that's the value of having a short form document with an introduction describing what its purpose is for Jewish ritual law, And then the simple agreement, which basically sets forth the terms that I have just described for you. Is a question in the back? You ask a question? Oh, are you asking specifically with respect to interest-bearing transactions, or are you asking in general? Asking in general, so that's a separate question. Obviously, if you're going to be an investment advisor, you have to be responsible and you have to provide full disclosure to your clients as to what their risks are and their exposure is with respect to any individual investment. It's very important for clients always to understand that no investment is completely risk-free, that there's always a potential or risk, that there's always a potential possibility for loss whenever there's any investment. If anything, I suppose that you could give advice that if you extend money to somebody subject to a shtar risko, that might be one of the best investments out there because it's generally a good, close to guarantee of return, since a shtar riskos generally have terms or conditions that are extremely difficult to satisfy. The big question that Rav Moshe Feinstein and others dealt with in part was, what if you know that the investment that you gave the person the money for went sour? You don't need edim or you don't need witnesses or an oath. You know, it's public, it's all over the place, it's all over the marketplace that the person who invested the money was a fraud. It turned out that it was all nothing. It was all invisible and make-believe investments. They cheated the world out of $50 billion, let's say, for argument's sake. And this was, you know, part of what the money was loaned for. So then how can you say that you're not going to believe the borrower, that he incurred a loss? So for that reason, Moshe says you really can't. In such a case, you're not entitled to a return on your investment because it's clear there was a loss. The whole world knows there was a loss. It doesn't matter that he doesn't provide witnesses. Everybody knows that he lost money. For that reason, many of the contemporary shtari iska are worded, or it's advised when you fill in the blanks, that you word it in such a way that you make it clear that you are giving over the money not for a specific known investment, but for any investment that the borrower, that the recipient of the funds might decide that they want to invest in. So you don't have to believe him that he put all his money in this place. Maybe he put all his money in gold or silver. There's no way of tracking or of guaranteeing that the money was placed in a particular place for a particular purpose, but rather it was simply extended in order to enable the person to have the wherewithal to invest in anything that they wanted. So that way you avoid those types of problems of knowing for sure that the person sustained a loss. There's also another, I should add that there's one line, if you look at the end of the shtar risk agreement, I basically gave you the essential background of most of the texts. The lender has agreed that in lieu of the sharing of profits and losses, which would require substantiation of all losses by two trustworthy witnesses and verification of all profits by oath, he shall accept my payment, namely the recipient's payment, of an annual percentage of blank percentage of the said sum of whatever it is, and waive all other profits which may be earned from the advance funds. And there's one last sentence that people often forget about, so I'll just mention it, which is that because of the fact that the extender of the funds is in fact making a loan, at least with 50% of the money, and that he's asking the person who's receiving the funds to invest money on which he's going to receive a return, so you know it takes a lot of effort to invest money. You have to consult with all of the experts as to what investments you should make. You have to look at all the newspapers, you have to read all the reports, you gotta read all of the prospectuses, you gotta be up on what's going on in the investment world. So that's a lot of work, that's called tircha. So it shouldn't appear that this recipient of the funds is undertaking all this tircha, all this hard work, because of the fact that I also happen to extend a loan to him. So therefore, in order that it shouldn't look like he's giving me back a service by undertaking this tircha, which is more than his 50% cut, so this is an extra amount that he's undertaking for himself, an extra amount of work, so it shouldn't look like he's doing that only because of the loan that I extended. That would be ribbis, so therefore I have to pay him for that tircha. I have to pay him for the work that he's doing in investing the money. I don't have to pay him a lot of money. I can pay him $1, but at the $1 I have to pay him. And if you look in every single sefer ever written about Hilchos Ribbis, almost everybody will say with great adamancy, I'm not sure, you can figure out the reasoning, they never explain the reasoning for some reason, but they say with great adamancy, this is not waivable. You can't say, hiskabalti. I consider it as if I received the $1. It has to really be paid. So at the time in which the funds are advanced, if you're giving a $100 loan, you got to make it $99. You got to make it $101. Excuse me. You got to give an extra dollar to the person that he's going to be able to keep, which is the payment that he's receiving for his undertaking in investing the money. So that's the last sentence. I have received a token payment of $1. That's the borrower talking from the said lender or extender of the funds. So my efforts in connection with this undertaking and have signed therewith the receipt of the said dollar. So that's an important aspect that often gets forgotten. Now sometimes that can be given over, not in the form of a dollar, but in the form of the person getting more of a return. So we could say that the profits will be shared instead of 50%, 50%, so the borrower will get 51%, I'll only get 49%. So you could do it that way, and that's another way of potentially structuring it if you're worried that the dollar is not always necessarily going to be physically paid. But that's an important part of the shtar iska, is to make sure that the borrower is getting something, at least for his efforts. So anyway, what Rav Moshe Feinstein and others discuss is in the context of banks. So you have major banking institutions sometimes are private banks that are owned by Jews. So if you have a private bank that's owned by Jews, so presumably then you have a Jewish entity, or you have an entity where the main stakeholders are Jewish, so they are bound by the laws of ribbis, by the laws of prohibited interest. So how can they ever borrow money or lend money? So Moshe Feinstein has a tremendous kiddush. He says that with respect to borrowing money, not everybody agrees with Moshe Feinstein, but he says that with respect to borrowing money, the prohibition only really applies if the borrower has personal liability. In Jewish law, there are two different aspects of liability. There's shibud aguf, which is a personal liability that if I don't pay you, then you can go after my assets, and you could take my furniture, and you could take my jewelry, you could take my house, you can take my money in the bank account, you could take everything. So that's personal liability. You could take my money, you could take the dollars out of my pocket, and then there's shibu nechasim, which means okay, you could take my house, but it's what we call non-course. You take my house and that's it. You can't go after me. You can't go after any of my other assets. If my house is worth the debt, you can collect your debt. If my house is worth half the debt, you only collect half the debt, but your only collateral is the house. So that's called shibud nechasim. So Moshe Feinstein says that the whole institution of ribbis is based on the premise that there's going to be shibud aguf. But if you have a corporation, which is limited liability, none of the shareholders have any personal liability. If the assets of the corporation are taken and there's nothing left, you can't go after the shareholders and the managers and collect from them. You can only collect from the assets. So if you can only collect from the assets, there's no shibud aguf, so there's no iser ribbis. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says there's no prohibition of interest whatsoever. So therefore, if you have a bank where there's a limited liability and there's no personal liability on the part of any of the bank's managers or shareholders, so then the bank would be allowed to borrow without worrying about the iser ribbis. So not everybody agrees with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Even those who disagree would generally be lenient that at least a rabbinically prohibited interest could be permitted for such an entity. But according to Rav Moshe, even biblically prohibited interest would be permissible if you're dealing with a limited liability corporation such as a bank. However, he says that's only true if the bank is borrowing money. But what if the bank is actually making a loan to other people? So if the bank is making a loan to another bank, or you have a corporation making a loan to another corporation, and there are no personal guarantees. If there's a personal guarantee, you have a person involved already. But there are no personal guarantees. So then you would be off the hook, according to Rav Moshe, because nobody has any personal liability. It's just one corporation loaning to another corporation. But says Rav Moshe, if I have a bank that actually makes loans to people, which is known to happen from time to time, bank loan makes a loan to people, so then the person is not a limited liability corporation. A person is a person. It's a real person. So the real person has shibud haguf, and then you would have a problem of interest. So in such a case, you would still need a shtar iska. So this comes up even when you're dealing with other entities that are not banks, like universities, like Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University is an entity. It actually makes loans and takes loans, right? So if it's taking a loan, it's borrowing money. So then presumably you might have the possibility of the heter of Moshe Feinstein to rely upon. But what if they're making the loan? They're making the loan, making a student loan, right? Let's say Yeshiva University loans money to a student. So the student has personal liability. They have to pay back the loan, and they have to pay back the loan with interest. So that would conceivably be a potential problem. So is there any way out of that problem? So there's a Gemara in Baba Metzia and Daf Ayin Amud Aleph, the Kos of Sheshis, who says to Moshe Yisomim, if you have money of orphans, so the money of orphans, you're allowed to loan out in such a way. The Gemara describes a particular manifestation of a way in which it's loaned out, where it's kav l'schar v'rochok mehefseh, where it's a rabbinically prohibited form of interest. So based on that Gemara, the Rosh says that whenever you have any kind of stuck institution, so a stuck institution is allowed to engage in rabbinically prohibited interest. So it would seem from there that if you're dealing with a stuck institution and it's extended to a place of a yeshiva, you have a yeshiva institution, so a yeshiva institution would be allowed to engage in rabbinically prohibited interest. But money, loaning money, we said, is biblically prohibited interest. It's not rabbinically prohibited interest. So some want to say that if it's not actually money that's being loaned, but it's a checks, that everything is done through checks, so maybe since checks are not actual physical money, based on a Tosos in Suvos and Iran, based on that Tosos, there's a possibility that maybe a shtar, that if somebody loans a shtar, a contract, instead of money, so maybe that's only rabbinically prohibited interest, according to the Ran's interpretation of Tosos, not put down in Shulchan Aruch. But the Bris Yehuda, one of the famous Sfarim, one of the first Sfarim, it was written on Hilchos Rippus, so he wants to argue that a check maybe has the halacha of a shtar, so if you're going to be lenient about a shtar, to only consider a rabbinically prohibited interest, maybe if everything is in the form of a check, maybe that's only rabbinically prohibited interest. That's a very questionable heter, because some say a check is not really like a shtar, and some say a shtar is that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say that a shtar is only rabbinically prohibited interest. That's that's one line in Iran, based on a Tosus, and even Tosus didn't say it. It's something that the Ran put into Tosfos. So there are many different levels of many hoops that you have to go through in order to rely on such a leniency. There's another leniency of the Rashba, where the Rashba says, if you look at the description of Ribbis in the Torah, so the description of Ribbis in the Torah basically describes a borrower person and a lender person, where I know I have a person extending the money, I have a person receiving the money. But if I have an entity where there's no Bailam Yiduim, there are no people who really are in charge. If you came to a university, say, who owns the university? Nobody owns the university. University owns a lot of things, but we don't own the university. So so whenever you have an entity where there are no bailim yiduim, says the Rashba, and this might be equated to the case of Hektish, which is described in the Gemara, where the Gemara indicates that Ribbis doesn't apply to Hektish. So whenever there are no Bailim Yiduim, there are no known owners, no known people who own the organization. It's like a corporation, at least there are shareholders who own the corporation. Yeah, nobody owns it. Nobody owns a university. Nobody owns a yeshiva. So the Rashba indicates that he thinks that maybe there's no Ribbis altogether in such a case. Then the Rashba says that he doesn't feel that anyone should rely upon this. This would cause a tremendous breach in the observance of the laws of Ribbis. Not everyone agrees that there is this category known as the with no Bailim Yiduim. But the Rashba indicates that certainly that's something which could be relied upon as well, at least when you're only dealing with Ribbis to Rabbanan, when you're only dealing with rabbinically prohibited interest. So you might be able to rely upon that paradigm as well. Student loans, one might argue that it's really only, I've heard this argument from others, that maybe it's only rabbinically prohibited interest for another reason, because maybe you're not loaning money to the student. The student is supposed to pay tuition. And and you're giving the student a product. You're giving him a wonderful education. That's something to pay for. That's a mecher. It's a transaction. That's a commerce. The university is providing a service, a great education, and the student is supposed to pay the money. But the university says, in return, but you're not paying the money right away, we'll let you pay the money later, but you'll have to pay a little bit extra if you're going to pay it later on. So therefore, that might be considered to be a sale transaction and not a loan transaction. If it's a sale transaction, by definition, it's only ribbis drabanan and it's only rabbinically prohibited interest. However, it would seem that in any type of situation, whether you're dealing with a yeshiva, whether you're dealing with something else, the best thing is to be equipped with a shtar iska. You're equipped with a shtar iska, and then you get around any of the problems, whether on a deraisa level or on a derabanan level, to be able to avert any possible appearances or problems of ribbis is certainly the best approach. The call hashitos, not to have to rely upon leniencies, some of which are sometimes questionable. It's important to bear in mind as well that if you are out in the business world and you are facilitating a ribbis transaction, meaning between two Jewish parties or two entities that would be considered to be Jewish owned or Jewish sufficiently Jewish managed according to halacha, then even a person who is a facilitator is considered to be a direct violator of the prohibition of ribbis. The Mishnah at the end of Perek Ezu Neshek in Bava Metzia says that the Edim, the witnesses to the transaction, violate the prohibition. The sofer of the transaction, the person who draws up the papers, violates the prohibition. The guarantor of the transaction violates the prohibition. So this is a very serious problem when you're going out into the business world to make sure that to the extent that you're involved in business transactions that involve the possibility of ribbis. This certainly is true. You go into the mortgage field, so you have mortgage brokers. You could have a mortgage brokerage firm in which you're originating mortgage loans, and you're dealing with many people who, in the Jewish community, who are bound by the laws of prohibited ribbis, and you're the one originating the loan. You're the lender, or you're facilitating the loan. So if it's a loan, which it would be, if it's a mortgage loan, which requires the payment of ribbis, which requires the payment of interest, so then you would be engaged in a direct violation of ribbis. So in my years at the Besdin, we would regularly be approached by people in the mortgage industry who are mortgage originators, mortgage brokers, who often would also double as originators, who would be assigning loans afterwards and so forth. They would come to us to work out shtar iska agreements. Now, sometimes it's not practical to enter into shtar iska agreements for every single individual loan. There was a device that was proposed by the Lublina Rav going back around 80 years ago in Europe, in which he proposed that when you have institutions that are regularly making loans all the time, and where it's not practical to sit down necessarily with every single borrower and to work out a shtar iska that's going to be signed by them, so he proposed that these organizations devise a heter iska klali, that they have a generalized form of shtar iska that just says that all of the transactions originated by our institution will be subject to the terms of a shtar iska, and you set forth the terms, and it's hanging on the wall, and every single transaction just sort of obliquely references this transaction is being done in accordance with our shtar iska, it's being done in accordance with the bylaws of the organization, which includes the shtar iska. So this was a device that was proposed by the Lublina Rav, which was accepted by many prominent authorities, that in a case where it's impractical to sit down and do a separate shtar iska with every single client, with every single person, to at least have a shtar iska klali that will be hanging, that will be available, that will be accessible, that will be incorporated into every single set of quote-unquote loan documentation, so that at least in your company, everything will be automatically, in that sense, subject to the shtar iska. And these are halachos that are extremely important, because the whole business world is predicated upon extending loans and collecting interest premiums. That's the underlying foundation of much of the world of the commercial world, much of commerce, much of the world of business and industry that we know. It's giving money for a guaranteed return. of some sort. If you don't have guaranteed return, so you're all set, except you might, you know, lose your shirt. But if you're extending money with a guaranteed return of principal and a payment of interest, so you have to be cognizant of these halakos, and you have to make sure that you don't run afoul of any problems in this regard. Yes. Right, that's a machlokas haposkim, as to whether somebody else would automatically take subject to the shtar isko, or whether it has to sort of separately be originated by the lender. Okay, but it's better to do a shtar isko in such a case than to have a repayment and then a new loan made to the third party.
My question was for Israeli banks, or for Jewish-owned banks, if they go to the secondary mortgage market and start selling mortgage-backed securities, how does that work if you have shtar isko on the mortgage?
That's a big discussion. There are a number of lengthy articles in the Yeshurun Journal, which is a publication right here on the Upper West Side with Shlomo Gottesman, Rabbi Shlomo Gottesman is the editor, that touches upon this topic about whether when you're selling the mortgages and it was originally a shtar iska, whether you have to enter into a new shtar iska, whether it's taken subject to the original shtar iska, what type of documentation will be necessary. It's a big machlokus as to what you have to do. There are lots of other issues in just the day-to-day life with respect to giving discounts for early payments and things of that sort that implicate ribbis issues. So it's just important to be aware, but mostly to be aware of the device of shtar iska that can help to avert many of these potential problems. So anybody who has any further questions, I invite anything else that you'd like to ask me, but maybe we'll do that privately. In the meantime, I'll let the rest of you go, and thank you very much, and have a good night.
Thank you.
We actually